Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Turteltaub, coming to you from Frankfurt today, and I'm sitting here with David Barr, who's a director of Campbell Barr, a compliance training firm most known for its live training. As much as we hear about web-based training, live training is still something that's very important to organizations, and we're going to be spending some time today talking about it. First of all, David, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Adam. Thanks for inviting me in.
So let's start with a basic question: is when is live training the better choice?
Well, as you'll know well, in ethics and compliance, we increasingly talk about biases, so I have to be careful asking that question to the person who started their own live training company. But where our discussions with clients are as to when is live, when is face-to-face the right time, it's really particularly when you're looking for a behavioral change. When you are simply conveying knowledge, here's our expenses policy, fill this in, put it in, this is the procedure, then absolutely web-based training can be a fantastic tool. But when we are looking at more of the human dynamic, human behaviors and human struggles, then the opportunities that live training bring, I think, give you a much greater chance to get success there. Now, that comes with some challenges on resources and other things, but more and more we recognize that it's not because we can tell people something different in live training than can be told web-based, but they can tell themselves. And real behavioral change comes from not what someone at the front of the room tells you, but what you come through the rigor of debate with your peers. And I think that's what makes the difference.
And so part of it then is the fact that it's not just the instructor teaching, it's listening to what others have to say in the room that makes the big difference.
100%. You know, we are there very clearly as facilitators. And as facilitators, one, you don't have all of the answers, but you are there to promote a conversation. Now, there's generally some structure behind that, there's some goals, but we want to use that opportunity to get people to bring out their own experiences and then adapt. And generally what you find is when you give people that opportunity, and it maybe takes a little bit of time to warm people up and you've got to think about some cultural differences, but people are incredible in the intelligence and the rigor that they'll bring to these discussions. I think often we kind of too often build slightly to the lowest common denominator or the lowest common perceived denominator. But actually, when we give people an opportunity and we trust the room to have a good conversation, then invariably, wherever I am in the world, I see that gets rewarded.
And then, yeah, it's worth noting that you're constantly traveling around the world. So what topics lend themselves best to live? You mentioned not so much a thing where it's, this is the process that you must follow, it's more human. You know, in terms of risk areas, are there some that are better than others?
Well, I suppose, and again, I have my own biases here, because all across ethics and compliance, the key risk areas all center around the human dynamic. Then, you know, even with regards to data privacy at the moment, we're absolutely, there is a lot of procedure and controls there, and elements of that will be well served by web-based training over the time. But actually, a lot of it at the moment is really getting audiences to engage that the world of data and data privacy has changed, the impact it has on corporate and society's behavior is just unimaginably different than what it was 10 years ago. So we're finding with clients and groups around the world that having an opportunity to have that why this matters conversation is a really important starting point to then build the more detailed procedures on top of. So certainly at the moment, data protection, but also anti-bribery, competition law, information security, and then across that the umbrella of ethical leadership, which increasingly is just becoming leadership and about those habits and behaviors. So We've been fortunate. We started out with very much a focus on anti-bribery, but then working together with our clients, it continues to expand.
So are there any areas where live training is less effective that you found?
So I think there are just the practical restrictions of how many people can you get in a room and have that, as we started off talking about, that discussion. So, you know, what we really urge clients to be wary of is not try and have a live training program that has such huge audiences that it just turns up to, you know, it's e-learning in a room.
It's just a large lecture hall and they're just, yeah, don't have to pay attention because they're so far away.
And that's it. People are, you know, they get excited. We really believe in live training, but we've got 10,000 people to train, so we need to do 200 people at a time. And we're not, that's not really live training as we mean it. So there are some real challenges with audience size. And often we'll have the conversation with clients there is, who really needs this training? Who are the most at-risk people? And often we'll find an initial audience size that might have been 2,000 people. If we're a little bit more targeted, we can bring that down to maybe a 300 to 500 population. And that becomes then a more achievable goal. So absolutely scale. And clearly, web-based has some great benefits there. There's no doubt that language is often a challenge. Fortunately, when you're with senior teams around the world, English is often the business language. But as you spread out from those, it's really, really important, if you want that conversation, that people feel able to speak up in their own language. So trying to find facilitators, be those external or within clients, who can deliver on that capability is really critical. And I think, if I'm honest, 5-6 years ago, we would kid ourselves we could do more in English than was really being effective. And now we really try and check ourselves on that and do as much as we can in local language.
Which is important because, again, what you're trying to do is encourage not a dialogue, not just or more than a dialogue, is more than between you as a teacher and the person attending, but amongst each other as well, that it's got to be something that everyone's capable of talking about and feels comfortable from a language perspective. So obviously, as we've talked, you know, one of the key things to think about is inviting as much audience engagement as possible.
Yeah.
Are there any tricks for this, you know, for trying to encourage it? I mean, I have to say, we once had an experience where we did something and found that one of the best ways to discourage it is to have all the senior leadership in the room with rank and file, because the rank and file didn't want to talk.
Yeah.
In front of are there any ways to make it better or worse?
Was it interesting your use of the term inviting that interaction? So I think what often gets overlooked is your training session starts not at 9 a.m. when the first person comes in, with the invite. And we often see that clients put huge resources, and this I think for me applies equally to web-based training as to live, huge resources into their training content and their program, and send out horrible invites. You know, this is the title of the training, it must be completed by this time. Why is anyone going to come with a positive attitude to there? So it's often thinking about the script of the invite and who's delivering that to really encourage someone to come along, as this is a development opportunity. This isn't an arm behind your back, we must tick this box. So I think investing and thinking about how the invite happens brings people into the room in a more positive manner. You're absolutely correct about talking with the company quite carefully about what's the right dynamic, and maybe having a senior person in the room that can really encourage people to say, this is being taken seriously, and therefore we can speak up. In other organizations, that might shut that down. Try not to prejudge that on a sort of global basis, but talk to the client about what can happen. Then we really try and put use the benefit of being live to put in some physicality early on. If we can get people, sounds very simple, up and moving and discussing, that brings an energy in and sort of breaks the nervousness down of the audience. So early participation, some physicality, just gets people moving and a little bit more open. And then also thinking about the size of the group. Again, it's not always possible to dictate this, but anywhere we would tend to say between 10 to 15 is ideal. It's enough to have diversity of experience and voice, but it's not so many that you can come into a room and think, well, I can just hide here for the next 3 hours and I'm not going to have to participate. Everybody's going to have a role to play. So invitation, room size, and that early interaction are what we find really encourages people to participate.
So let me ask you one final question. When it comes to this, you talk about the fact, don't think of the training as all the training. That think from the invitation point, that's setting the tone, trying to get people in the right frame of mind. What do you find is best for follow-up after the training's done?
Yeah, and that's, we're seeing a lot more focus on that now. Clients wanting to discuss from the outset, okay, you know, here's the training, but how are we following this up? And there are a few different approaches. So we've got a number of clients now that at the end of a session will often be drawing to some conclusions, asking people to make their commitments, but then we'll put them into small groups, and in the room they schedule a call 4 weeks after the session, say. That can vary, where they all get a chance to share their commitments. And then it's their choice if they want to keep that group going. And we've seen a number of clients that's been surprisingly successful, sort of started as a trial, and that's generated some really good feedback. The other thing was often we would try and give people content to deliver on to their audience, but we would often give them half of the session. So, you know, here's an hour and a half. Isn't that a great resource to give you? And it was too much. We were kidding ourselves. We were overloading, and people didn't feel comfortable to take that. What we have found is if we give people little 5 to 10 minutes interactions that come from the session, so they've seen that conversation, they know how it works, and they can go and take that on to their own team, that's getting really good engagement. And then the clients can follow up with that internally. What did those conversations drive? And they're actually getting their managers and leaders sort of asking for more of that content. So that planning as to the takeaways and the follow-ups is something we're seeing as a much more integral part of what is a live training program than it was even 2 or 3 years ago.
That's interesting. I mean, for 2 points. One is the idea of thinking through not just the singular moment, but the range of it, but also in a lot of ways, sort of the training starts a pattern of rehearsing, and then the follow-ups do, so it helps people better when they face the situation, having rehearsed these things, gone through the issues.
100%. And we started off about the importance of that rigorous debate and discussion in the room. And what we're finding is that often in so many work environments nowadays, we're so busy, so much is done electronically, that a lot of teams, not through any bad intention, have lost the rigor of regular and formal conversations, those open habits. And that really needs to be practiced. And being able to leverage off live sessions to give managers tools to practice those little conversations so that when a real issue comes along, it's almost become a habit to talk about these things is, I think ourselves and a number of our clients have been surprised a little bit as to how critical that's become to encourage that type of practice. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that coming along in the next few years, I think.
Good. Well, David, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us here, and also you'll be speaking later today. Thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen. I'm Adam Turteltaub from SCCE and HCCA saying I hope we were able to expand your compliance perspectives.